For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, we are in Mark 7, verses 1 to 23. I'm not going to read the whole passage because it's long, but we'll get to the heart of it, in which Jesus begins a series of discussions of slightly a more confrontational nature with the Jewish religious establishment over the issue of what really is the problem with humankind before God, and what is God going to do to deal with that problem. And it has a lot to do with the heart. And so let's just take a look at the setting and kind of get our anchor here in verse 5, rather, of chapter 7. It says that the Pharisees and teachers of the religious law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples follow our age-old tradition? They eat without first performing hand-washing ceremony." So here the religious establishment, these rabbis that are kind of like the experts on Judaism, they're from down in Jerusalem. They've been going up north and they've been scoping out what Jesus and his disciples are doing. They want to make sure that everything is just kosher, you know what I mean? And they're finding out that, in fact, it's not. That here these disciples, they're not washing their hands. It's how they're not washing their hands that becomes offensive to the Jewish leadership. Because for them, it's not enough that you get dirt off your hands. It's that you go even further than that, and in a ceremonial way, and just with exactly the right amount of water filled up with just enough egg shells to drip over your hands, that you are in a ritual way cleaning yourself before a meal. And Jesus, as we have seen before, really doesn't have a whole lot of patience for that kind of arcane religiosity. He's just not into it. He's just not into the whole traditions that have grown around a much more important area that this issue touches on, which is the idea of the clean laws of the Old Testament. And so really this whole half of the chapter is about this part of the Old Testament law and what was done with that by Jewish religious tradition over the centuries that has nothing to do with the Bible, dealing with cleanliness. And so, you know, that's just something that doesn't really communicate in our culture. We may or may not have washed our hands before eating our meals today. It's unlikely that we associate any kind of religious significance to that act. Well, in the Old Testament world, that was a very big deal indeed. And that there are laws in the Old Testament, the law of Moses, that are specifically about the importance of cleanliness. And by that, I don't, again, mean the washing of germs off your hands or something like that, although it includes that. But it has a broader understanding of what kinds of foods, for instance, are clean and therefore acceptable. And as I suppose we all know, the Jewish people do not eat pork products, crustaceans, other kinds of food. And there's a reason for that, and the first and primary reason is for the ethnic and cultural separation that God intended to have for his people in the Old Testament world. He wanted his people to stand out in a very distinct way. And so, you know, obviously, circumcision would be the permanent physical manifestation of that, but also their dietary laws and cleanliness laws, things like that, also fit in. And the idea is that they're being purified as the people of God from their neighbors who, and in the Old Testament world, you know, you can't really separate social customs, taboos, things like that from the broader religious worldview that was universally held. It's like in today's world, if you go to Saudi Arabia, you say, "Is there such a thing as a Saudi without being a Muslim?" And they look at you like you're nuts, because of course to be Saudi is to be Muslim, right? Now, in the Old Testament world, in the ancient Near East, of course, these are very religious cultures, and to be an ethnic people is by definition also to be a religious people. And God was very interested in a distinct religious people, His people, through whom He is going to effect His work through human history and on behalf of all of humanity. But in that window that is the Old Testament, it's God's intent to keep His people fundamentally without being influenced by these ancient Near Eastern cultures. And we've talked at some length in other discussions on Sunday nights about that, especially when we were in our study of Jeremiah and just the appalling nature of these religious cultures. And so these cleanliness laws are just ways of daily reminding God's people not to assimilate and that you are distinct from your neighbors that are around you. Now, on the other hand, too, it's not just an identifying of people by way of contrast. This is what we're not. We're not into Baal worship or whatever. But on a more positive note, these cleanliness laws communicated a certain sort of purity to God. And just by way of symbol, really, that's all it is. It's not, there's nothing intrinsically important about pork products as opposed to beef products or any number of things like this. That's not the point. There's a deeper point, and which is that God, through these rules, is signaling out a people for Him, that they're special to Him, that there's a relational element that is presumed in these cleanliness laws, and you see them used over and over in the Old Testament, specifically in the context of the marriage metaphor, the idea that Israel is, in a very important way, God's bride, that God has a love, an affection, a care, a relationship, as it were, with Israel like a man would have for a woman. And so there's this idea that through these outward rituals of cleanliness, that God's people were keeping themselves pure for Him in an analogous way that a bride would keep herself pure from relationships with other men, intimate relationships with other men, before she's married. And so in Hosea, in Jeremiah, in the Old Testament, the same metaphor is used in the New Testament by Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, interestingly. There is this idea that God wants to have this deep relationship with His people that can only be framed in terms of the most intimate relationship that humans can conceive, which is the marriage relationship, and that to be ready for that relationship is to keep oneself pure and singularly devoted. That's the concept. Are you with me? That's the idea, as it's laid out in the Old Testament. And for our purposes, and especially as we see where Jesus goes with this, it presents yet another facet of what is the gospel. What is the good news about Jesus Christ? And we have seen a lot of different windows that God has given to us into what is the nature of this good news. Last week we were talking about in the feeding of the 5,000, John's account of that event. He says, "I am the bread of life." And the idea is that there's a hunger that human beings apart from God have, and that nothing can satisfy that gnawing within. The soul is restless until it finds its peace in God, says Augustine. And so Jesus presents Himself as the one to satisfy that deep passion, that deep need that nothing else can meet. But we've also seen Jesus communicate the good news in terms of the victory over death in the raising of Jairus' daughter. We've seen Jesus communicate the good news of reconciliation between an alienated humanity and God. We've seen the good news presented in terms of forgiveness of guilty people before God. And so now we're bringing all this stuff in and we're saying on every meaningful level of human experience, God wants to meet you at that place, and that is good news. And what's being described here, God comes to us in yet another way, and which is this idea that we are not clean, that there is a certain, and you reflect on your own conscience, and that sense of filth I mean, that's not really something that people talk about very much in our culture today for reasons that I want to talk about in a minute. But that deep sense of, I'm not worthy to approach God. That there's something that as I reflect on my conscience and my life, I sense a certain amount of shame for the choices that I've made and for the effect that that's had on other people. And Jesus uses in this passage the word defiled. It's just like, you know, I've done some things and I've been about some things. I'm not proud of those things. And they have in an important way defiled me. They've corrupted who I am and have made this beautiful image of coming into this intimate partnership, this intimate relationship with God. You just realize, I'm not ready for that. I'm not prepared. I'm not the one that a righteous God would want to pursue. Now, I think a lot of us can relate to that thought here this evening as you reflect back on your past and you realize, man, there's an awful lot about me I'm not proud of. And I feel a sense of a certain sort of shame with that, an amount of internal filth and rottenness about who I am, what I've been about, my suitability for a suitor like him. And if that in any way connects with your experience, then you are really understanding the whole force of this great passage here. And the hope that Jesus is going to bring, namely that there is a way of becoming clean. And we even use that same language today. When we say, hey, you know, it's time for you to come clean about your life, Mark. What am I saying? I'm saying, Mark, let's be honest. Let's own up to what's really there, right? So in that sense, that's very much along the lines of how the Bible uses this concept. But even more deeply, okay, to come clean is to own up. It's to say, here's who I am with all my rottenness. But the real interest in coming clean is getting clean. And here again, we use language in our culture today that's not at all far removed from the original intent as the Bible describes it. To become clean, to be free of contaminants. You know, there are things that have been competing for our hearts. And we have yielded to those things and have contaminated our fidelity, our faithfulness, our loyalty to God. The Old Testament called those things idols. The serving of wealth. The serving of our own egos, of reputation, of things like that. Some of us have really pursued our pleasures to such an extent that we know that we're not free and that our loyalties and our passions are very much torn in what were once vices are now habits. And we desperately have that sense, oh, if I could only be free of this addiction, this compulsion that drives me. And boy, isn't that a big issue? For a lot of us, we find that we are habitually about the project of getting even, of holding a grudge, of being the alcoholic, of never getting past offenses done to us, of never being able to subordinate my game plan for the true needs and interests of other people. We are dirty. There is a mix of who we are at a deep level, and we're contaminated at that point, and we sense it, and we know it, and we want to get clean. And that involves resolving this shameful awareness that we have, that in the service of my idols, in the depths of my filth, that I have compromised the person that God has made me to be. And that I know that that is what's really ultimately best for me to be as well. I've gone my own way. And so the gospel then has to do with resolving that shame and restoring a guilty person with a filthy heart to real purity before God. And that's, I think that's just a very beautiful picture of what the gospel is. and just all of that unresolved gook down in your heart. You know, get inside an engine sometime. Mix it up. That's a dirty, gooky place. And you just, everything, time you bump into something, you got more filth on you, and you turn around, more filth still. And hey, man, welcome home. That's your heart. And God is saying, I have a cleaner, and I have a way to just wipe all that away so that you're like totally prepared to be betrothed to the holy God of the universe. That's a real appealing kind of thought. Well, let's get into it, because Jesus is going to have to interact with some things that are getting in the way, the religious leadership. How do we get defiled? How do we get clean? That's really the issue that Jesus is talking about here. And he goes on, he says they're chastising Jesus because his disciples are not obeying the cleanliness traditions that they've developed. And it says that Jesus replied in verse 6, "You hypocrites! Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship is a farce, for they teach man-made ideas as commandments from God." Well, you know, you can always count on Jesus to more or less call it the way it is. And so he does here. And what does he say of these people who have very deep interests in externalized religion, of ritual that makes you look clean but doesn't really deal with the inner filth that is our life? He says, "You hypocrites." You know what a hypocrite is? In the ancient world, in Greek tradition, a hypocrite is a person who wears a mask. An actor who wears a mask. That's a hypocrite. And it's like, you know, what does it communicate? It communicates that what you're showing me, interesting as it might be, is a total fake. That you're just acting. That we don't really have access to the real you because you're just putting up appearances. And Jesus says, that is exactly what happens in a religious framework, where we externalize these deep issues that we were describing just a minute ago. That in a religious environment, that religion comes to replace God's interest in relationship for the sake of ritual. And pretty soon, you know, I'm sure the truth is in there somewhere, but it's so obscured by so many layers of standing up and sitting down and reciting this and smelling that and all this kind of stuff. It's like, you know, what does it even mean? And that is a problem with tradition, and that's exactly what was being laid on the people, the Jewish people of Jesus' day. It's like, they understood what the traditions were about. They had no idea that didn't come anywhere from their Bible. God never said those things. And that they're all caught up in the wrong thing. And what God wants is us to understand how deeply He wants to relate to us. And what does religion and tradition teach? It teaches us how to sing and dance. And how to genuflect and all this type of thing, how to repeat phrases, the meaning of which has long been lost. We may feel in a religious tradition a sense of mystical experience, feel somehow different or altered, or you know, just the mood of the event is such that it's moving to me. But that's not what God doesn't care if we're moved. God wants to work in our lives to bring about real change. And so what these religious traditions were doing in Jesus' day and what they continue to do all the way down to the present day is that they really confuse what the real issue is. We were talking earlier this week, Steve and I were talking about, you know, these great prayers that people would write out in the Protestant Reformation in England in the 17th and 18th century, and And just so beautiful and eloquent are these prayers of people personally engaging and interacting with God. How important that was after centuries of a religious tradition that was performed in Latin, so the people had no idea what was even being said, and certain ceremonies of waving of the arm over certain objects, which later got referred to simply as hocus pocus. It's a spin on the Latin. What does this even mean to relate to God? Well, these early Reformation leaders were writing out their prayers so that people could have a sense for this is what it really looks like to relate to God in a personal way. It was codified then in the Book of Common Prayer, which has now become the Protestant relic that people mindlessly ape, having no idea of what it actually means. And so there's just this mentality, this mindset that cuts across denominations and traditions and everything else, because for some reason, the dirty heart of man loves to cling to traditions. Makes us feel better. In Jesus' world, it also meant that certain kinds of sin was legitimized. In verses 9 to 13, Jesus says, you know, here's the weird thing about you people. You love the outward ceremonies. You like to look religious. And so, for instance, you'll take your wealth and you'll say to the priest at the temple, yeah, hey, so when I die, I want you to inherit my property, my wealth. Of course, I'm going to use it freely while I'm still alive, but when I'm gone, you can pick it up. You can have it. And they were using this then as an excuse to tell their parents, my property is korban, which means dedicated to God. And in other words, sorry, Mom, sorry, Dad, I just don't have any money to help you out in your old age. So have a nice day. And Jesus is like, oh, could I have been more clear when I said honor your father and your mother? I thought that was pretty clear, but now you've developed this tradition that says, well, what does it mean, you know, and maybe there's a way out over here, and they just put that legal edge to it, and they legitimize not caring about their parents, who they turn away in destitution in their old age. Sick stuff. Here's what we're saying. That tradition is not spiritually neutral, and there are places where it is no longer morally neutral either. And in a fallen world with corrupt people like me and you, these unthinking traditions of men, whether they be in Judaism or Christianity or in whatever they are things that people begin to rely on. They trust in these things really at the expense of what God, without any ambiguity, has said himself. And so Jesus is not taking some conciliatory tone. He's squaring off with these people and he's saying, you hypocrites! You actors! You put on a face, but you're so full of it! Well, okay. What's the problem? Three times he says, now citing Isaiah 29, he says, their hearts are far from me. You know, externally, they're saying all the right things. You could dictate into a tape player and just have that go on for the rest of your life. And it would be about as meaningful as this. He goes on in verse 14, Jesus called the crowd together and he says, all of you listen and try to understand. It's not what goes into your body that defiles you. You are defiled by what comes from your heart. Again, that concern for the heart. Then Jesus went into a house to get away from the crowd. And his disciples asked him what he meant by the parable. Don't you understand either, he asked. Can't you see that the food you eat can't defile you? Food doesn't go into your hearts, but passes through your stomach and goes into the sewer. And Mark adds parenthetically, by saying this, he declared every kind of food clean. In other words, Jesus at that moment is saying, All the cleanliness laws of the Old Testament are fulfilled. They're no longer binding. Then he added, it is what comes from inside that defiles you. From within, out of a person's heart, come evil thoughts and sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, wickedness, deceit, lustful desires, evil, slander, pride, and foolishness. Well, that seems like a fairly adequate list, doesn't it? And then he concludes, all these vile things come from within, and those are the things that defile you. Has nothing to do with your traditions. It has nothing to do with outward appearances and religious practices of any kind. Here's what the real problem is. The real problem is your rotten heart. And the religious person, of course, you know, they want to be able to salve what's left of their ego after an interaction like this. And from the religious mindset and the mindset that Jesus is addressing here, it's outside-in thinking. And this, quite frankly, is a universal in religion. Okay? It's a universal in religion. And all religion is outward working its way in. You are what you do. Your works define you. Man, in the Asian religions, that's what karma is. Karma literally means that you are the sum total of your deeds. It couldn't be more legalistic. In the religious framework of Jesus' day, you are basically coming into the world a morally neutral thing, and what defines you then is your relative good deeds compared to your relative bad deeds. It's all about what you do, and what you do then defines who you are. And that's why, of course, these external practices are so important. I've got to do the right thing so that I'm able to, you know, present myself as a more good person than bad person. This type of thing. All religion is this way. All religion, of course, except for biblical faith. The secular approach, interestingly enough, that is to say, the kind of the thinking that really dominates the culture without really consciously often in most people's minds rearing its head. It's how we're taught to think. It's not how we're taught what to think. Interesting. Anyhow, there's a current in our thinking in this culture that's very much along the lines of the religious thinking that is more or less observable across the world, even among unreligious people. And here's the idea that you basically are good. Everyone's basically good. And that's a new idea. That's really within the last couple hundred years since we've moved into what's been called the Enlightenment era, where we've thrown away the vestiges of God and really focus on what matters, which is humankind. The defining word that has so much influenced our culture from the French thinker Jean-Jacques Rousseau in his Social Contract, it opens like this. He says, man is born free, but everywhere is in chains. Man's nature is good. Man is born free, but everywhere finds himself in chains, fettered to one sort of thing or another. And it is out of this kind of assumption, then, that we have looked with romantic eyes to humankind and said, you know, what's really important is to find yourself, to be yourself. Does that sound familiar to you? I hope it does, because if it doesn't, you're not listening. This is the dominant thinking of our culture. I've got to strip away the things that seek to control me and define me, and I got to find myself, I got to be myself. And when problems arise, well, that of course is the consequence of the environment around me or the biology that drives me. You know, yeah, I do have problems in my life, and you would too if you had the genes I've got. I couldn't help but be the way I am. Given that, and of course, oh my God, the environment, you know, that I have. And some of us come from very tough places. I don't mean to diminish this point. I'm not suggesting that there are not influences in our biology and in our environment that are real and that are powerful. The question is, are they defining? Are they defining? And in our culture, the way we look at it, if you think about, for instance, just one of many fields, the field of psychology illustrates this very well. Carl Menninger, years ago, the founder of the Menninger Clinic, the best known psychiatrist of the second half of the 20th century, wrote a book called Whatever Became of Sin. And he said, well, here's what became of sin. Sin became a symptom. Sin, that is bad behavior, became a symptom of a person who's just not put together very well and who had traumatic experiences in their life, had bad breeding, was in a poor environment, whatever it might be. There's nothing wrong with that person. They're good. It's just that they got all this stuff piled on them. He wrote another book, this is very telling, called The Crime of Punishment. And what does he mean by this? It's like, well, look, if what you are is this good person that has had the misfortune of being trapped in the social conditions that have kind of programmed you to be who you are and to act the way you do, well, then, you know, it's not your fault. You're a victim. And to treat you like a criminal would itself be criminal. You understand how this works? And so it's just that whole kind of victim mentality begins to emerge, and everyone has been wronged by family, wronged in school, wronged at work, wronged, 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 and we look around, I'm all frickered up, and why is it? Well, the problem's always out there. The problem's always out there. In depth psychology and in Freudian analysis, you know, the true you is your id, that animalistic you that wants to eat, drink, and procreate. And if we just took off the masks of cultural bondage called the superego, the mores that try to keep us in line, that repress our true nature, you know, that's the kind of person we would be. And so we just live in this culture then that celebrates the romantic idea, you are okay. The problems in your life, they're all out there. They're all out there. And so no wonder then we have these values as a culture that we want to just cocoon ourselves away. We want to shield ourselves. We want to shield our children from all of the ills that are out there. The contaminants of people of lesser quality or whatever it might be. And that is the kind of the middle class bourgeois ethic that is about what our culture largely is about, and that's where it comes from. And folks, that is not a biblical idea. That's not what God says. It's not what God says. We're not basically good. The problems that we have, real as they may be, from our environment and from our genetics, are not at the heart of it, the real problem in our life. I like the way Adam put it in Genesis 3, after God busted him. He says, well, it was the woman that you gave me. That's a double whammy. It's not only not my fault, it's my wife's fault, and if that's not good enough, it's your fault! You put her there for God's sake! Oh man, you know, that's just the way human nature operates, isn't it? It's always out there. Always out there. And what Jesus is doing, he's putting up this big mirror and he's saying, there's the problem. You know, and the religious, they don't want to see that. And the prideful, they don't want to see that. And you and I, most of the time, we don't want to see that. But God, in His mercy, wants us to see that because He's got a solution. He says, you're defiled by what comes from your heart. And this is really the issue and the area. This is where God is really doing His thing. And which is, I think, very awesome and very beautiful. The outside-in approach is hopeless. You're never going to have the perfect environment. People are never going to really understand you like you feel that you need to be understood. It's too late to change your genetics. You should have thought of that before you were born. You know, all of the things that we look to are hopeless because they cannot be changed. And how despairing it is to live as though somehow the pressing issues of my life have nothing to do with me and they are not things that can be resolved by anything I can do. And yet that is what religion puts out, and that is honestly, that is at the heart of secular thinking about human beings' problems as well. How hopeless that is. Look, if the heart is the issue, as Jesus says three times here, if the heart is the issue, then there is reason for hope. Why? Because God alone can cleanse the heart. That's what the Bible teaches. God has the power and God has the authority to cleanse you at a place that you can't get to. I love what David says in Psalm 51. This is after he has this discussion with his buddy Nathan. And David was a great man. He's referred to as a man after God's own heart. So he's a great man, and yet he's a man full of foibles and full of limitations, full of sin, full of uncleanness in his heart. And that manifests itself in his dastardly deed of killing a man and taking his widow to be his wife. And his buddy Nathan, the prophet, was not going to let that fly. And he goes to David and he says, David, I got a story for you. This guy comes to a rich man's house, and in the ancient tradition of hospitality, you know, you've got to throw on a banquet for him. And so this rich man looks out at his vast herd of sheep and he decides, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to take my neighbor's sheep, the only one they have. I'm going to take that one and serve it up to my wayfaring guest. And David, when he hears about this, just goes ballistic and he says, that man deserves to die for what he did. And Nathan goes, David, ecce homo, thou art the man. And he's like, oh, you know, skewed on his own petard. And he realizes in a moment, what am I? I am a hypocrite. I put on the King David face. But inside, I'm just looking for opportunity to exploit, to use my position to my advantage. And God took him down on that point. And God had an interaction with David that David records in Psalm 51. It's very beautiful. He says, "Purify my sins and I will be clean. Wash me and I will be whiter than snow. Give me back my joy again. You have broken me. Now let me rejoice. Don't look at my sins. Remove the stain of my guilt and create in me a clean heart, O God." Well, see, David understood the gospel. David understood that only God has the authority and the power to meet us at the core of who we are and to wash away that shame, that filth, that unworthiness, that sin. And that is what God has on the table for us here tonight. Let's not play religion, put on airs, follow the right traditions. God is saying, "I'm ready to have an encounter with you here tonight. You can approach me in your hubris and in your pride and in your arrogance and in your filth. Or you can come to me in humility and just say, 'God, I suck.'" You know, and there's a long list of things that really do define my twisted heart. And I'm asking you, forgive me, cleanse me, give me that new heart. And God is eager to do that because God wants to make you presentable to Him in this intimate way that we described early, that can only be conceived in terms of the relationship of a lover to the beloved. And that's God's heart for you. And God is able to make that happen in your life. And He's just calling on you to come clean. Come clean. Call it what it is. And humbly receive what you cannot earn. That's the gospel. And the life of the gospel then, lastly, is simply God continuing to work from the inside out, to work out through our emotional life, through our psychological condition, through our relationships, through all that we are, the implications of the new heart that He's caused to thrive and to beat within us. That's the Christian life. And it's just so awesome. He in no place tells these religious people, "Try harder. Be good. Here's some more rules for you." You know, none of that's there. It's very simple. It's humble your heart before me and then be generous with your heart to the people around you. That's the Christian life. Sweet. Let's pray together.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.